meaning to. What happened to Lida? The radio didn't say much except that her body'd been found. I can't tell you how shocked I was. It's horrible. I told her the details, sparing little. Ordinarily, I'd downplay the particulars, not wanting to pander to the public appetite for the gruesome specifics of violent death. With Ava, I felt the reality of the situation might loosen her tongue. She listened to me with distaste, her dark eyes filling with anxiety. "Do you mind if I smoke?" she said. "Not at all. Go ahead." She opened the bottom drawer of her desk and pulled out her handbag. Her hands were trembling as she shook a Winston from the pack and lit it. "I've been trying to quit, but I just can't help myself. I stopped at the drugstore and picked up a pack on the way to work. I smoked two in the car." She took a deep drag. One of the engineers peered around from his drafting table as the smoke drifted toward him. She had her back turned so she missed the look of annoyance that crossed his face. "Let's go back to Hugh's death," I said. "I can't help you much with that. I'd only been with the company a few weeks before he died, so I hardly knew the man."
"Was there an office manager before you?"
Ava shook her head. "I was the first, which meant the office was a mess. Nobody did a thing. Filing alone was piled up to here. There was just one secretary. Heather was the receptionist, but all the day-to-day business was handled by Woody himself or one of the engineers. It took me 6 months to get things squared away. Engineers may be obsessive, but not when it comes to paperwork." She took another drag, then tapped the small accumulation of ash from the end of her cigarette. "What was the atmosphere like at the time? Was it tense? Was anybody caught up in an office dispute? A feud of any kind?" "Not that I ever heard. Woody bid on a government contract, and we were trying to get organized for that."
"Which entailed what?"
"Routine office procedure, forms to be filled out, clearances, that kind of thing."
"What happened to the bid?"
"Nothing. The whole thing fell through. Woody had a heart attack, and after he died, Lance let the matter drop."
"What was it they were bidding on? I wonder if that ties in."
"I don't remember what it was. Hold on, I'll ask." Ava turned and scanned the room. John Salkowitz was passing through, blueprint in hand, apparently on his way to the rear of the plant.
"John, could I ask you about something over here?"
He detoured toward us, his expression clouding with concern when he caught sight of me.
"What's the story on Lida Case? My wife just called and said she heard about her on the news."
I gave him the shorthand version, putting it together with the question at hand. "I'm still trying to figure out how it ties into this business with Lance. There's got to be a connection somewhere."
"He's not seriously being accused of insurance fraud, is he?"
"Looks that way. Along with me, I might add."
"Appalling," he said. "Well, I don't see how it could have any bearing on the contract we bid on, but I'll fill you in. We get a little trade paper called Commerce Daily, published by the government. It was Hugh's job to check it for any contract available for bid that might apply to us. He found one under heating equipment, requesting bids on a furnace for processing beryllium, which is used in the making of nuclear bombs and rocket fuel. It's hazardous work."
"We'd have had to build in a whole new venting system to accommodate Cal OSHA, but if we got it, we'd have been in a position to bid on future contracts."
"Woody felt it was worth the expense of retooling. Not all of us agreed with him, but he was a shrewd man, and you had to trust his instincts. Anyway, that's what we were going after."
"What would it have been worth to the company?"
$250,000 bucks. $500,000, maybe. More, of course, in the long run, if we bid on future work."
"What was the status of the bid when Hugh died?"
"I don't know. I guess we were gearing up. I know he'd gone down to the federal building in Los Angeles to pick up all the paperwork. Since it was the Department of Defense, we were going to need a company clearance, plus individual clearances. Hugh's death really didn't have much effect, but when Woody died on top of that, we lost heart."
"Could the company have handled the work with both men gone?"
"Probably, but of course Lance was just taking over, getting his feet wet. I guess we dropped the ball, but that's all it amounted to. We weren't out anything. We might not have been low bidder anyway, so it's all speculative."
"What about bid since?"
"That's an aspect of the business we haven't paid much attention to. We're on overload half the time as it is."
I looked at him, truly stumped.
"And you don't think it's relevant?"
"If it is, I don't see how."
"Thanks for your time, at any rate. I may need to get back to you."
"Sure thing," he said.
Ava and I chatted a while longer, but the conversation seemed unproductive, except for one minor point.
She mentioned in passing that Ebony had attended the memorial services for Hugh Case. I thought she was in Europe, married to some playboy named Julian.
She was, but they came back to the States to visit every 6 months or so.
How long had she been in town? Do you have any idea?
Her look was blank.
Can't help you there. I was too new myself to sort out what was normal in that family.
Maybe I can check it out, I said.
Thanks for your help.
Driving back into town, I was kicking myself. I'd falsely assumed that neither Ebony nor Bass could have been tied into Hugh's death, as both of them were out of the picture at the time, Ebony in Europe, Bass in New York. Now I wasn't sure. I stopped at a public phone booth and called the Woods house. The maid answered. I was willing to talk to just about any member of the family, but that turned out to be problematic. Mrs. Wood was resting and had asked not to be disturbed. Ebony and Ashley had gone to the Santa Teresa Monument Company to look at memorial tablets for Miss Olive's gravesite. Bass was due back at any minute. Did I care to leave my name and number? I decided to hold off on that. I said I'd call again later and hung up without identifying myself. I hauled more change from my handbag and tried Darcy at the office. She had nothing new to report. I brought her up to date, and we commiserated briefly on the blanks we were drawing. She said she'd leave word on my answering machine if anything developed. Fat chance, I thought. I returned to my car and sat there at the curb. I poured the rest of the hot coffee into the thermos lid, sipping it with care. I was getting closer to the truth. I could feel it in my bones. I felt like I was circling, the orbits getting tighter as I approached the central point. Sometimes all it took was one tiny nudge and everything fell into place. But the balance was delicate, and if I pushed too hard, I might barge right past the obvious. I didn't have that many trees to shake. I screwed the lid on the thermos and tossed it in the back seat. I started up the car and drove back into town again. Maybe Andy's mistress had heard from him. That might help. 15 minutes later, I was standing at her door, knocking politely. I wasn't sure if she worked or not. She was home, but when she opened the door, she didn't seem that thrilled to see me. "Hi," said I. "I'm still looking for Andy, and I wondered if you'd heard from him." She shook her head. Some people think they can lie to me that way, without forming the actual falsehood with their lips. It's apparently part of an inner conviction that if they don't speak the lie aloud, they won't burn in hell.
He never checked in to let you know he was okay?
I just said that, didn't I?
Seems odd to me, I remarked. I half expected him to drop you a note or make a quick phone call.
Sorry, she said. There was a tiny silence wherein she was hoping to close the door and be done with me.
How'd he get that account anyway, I asked.
What account?
Wood Warren. Did he know Lance pretty well, or was it someone else in the family?
I have no idea. Anyway, he's the claims manager. I don't know that he sold the policy in the first place.
Oh, somehow I thought he did. I thought I saw that somewhere on one of the forms we processed.
Maybe it was his account before he got promoted to claims manager.
Are you through asking questions? She said snappishly.
Well, actually, I'm not. Did Andy know any of the Woods personally? I don't think you told me that.
How do I know who he knew?
Just thought I'd take a flyer, I said. It puzzles me that you're not worried about him. The man's been gone, what, 4 days? I'd be frantic.
I guess that's the difference between us, she said.
Maybe I'll check out at his place again. You never know. He might have stopped back at the apartment to pick up his clothes and his mail.
She just stared at me. There didn't seem a lot left to say.
Well, off I go, I said cheerfully. You've really been a peach.
Her goodbye was brief. 2 words, one of which started with the letter F. Her mama apparently hadn't taught her to be ladylike any more than mine had taught me. I decided to drive back out to Andy's place because, frankly, I couldn't think what else to do.
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
Chapter 23. I headed out to the condominium complex where Andy lived, thrilled that I wasn't going to have to type up a report on the day's events. The truth was, I had no plan afoot, no strategy whatever for wrapping this business up. I didn't have a clue to what was going on. I was driving randomly from one side of the city to the other, hoping that I could shake something loose. I was also avoiding my apartment, picturing the gendarmes at my door with a warrant for my arrest. Andy represented one of the missing links.
Someone had designed an elaborate scheme to discredit Lance and eliminate two key engineers at Wood Warren. Andy had facilitated the frame-up. But once Olive was blown to Kingdom Come, he must have decided to blow town himself. If I could pinpoint the connection between Andy Motyka and the person who'd suckered him into it, then maybe I could figure out what the payoff was. The electronic gates at the cop stood open, and I passed through without attracting armed guards or vicious dogs. A tall, fair-haired woman in a jumpsuit was walking an apricot poodle, but she scarcely looked at me. I parked my car in the slot Andy had left in the wake of his departure. I trotted up to the second-floor landing and let myself in with the front door key, which I knew from past experience he kept hidden on the cornice above the front door. I confess I sniffed the air apprehensively as I let myself in, mindful that Andy might have ended up in the same state as Lida Case. The apartment smelled benign, and the dust that had settled on the empty bookshelves attested to the fact that no one had been here for days. I did a quick pass through the apartment to make sure it was unoccupied. I opened the rear sliding glass door, peered into each bedroom, then returned to the living room where I drew the front drapes. I moved through the daylight gloom with curiosity. Andy lived on such Spartan terms that his place had looked abandoned even when he was in residence. Now, however, the emptiness had the aura of a vacant lot, the wall-to-wall carpeting littered with paper scraps. In situations like this, I always long for the obvious. Cryptic messages, motel receipts, itineraries indicating where the missing might have gone. The various bits of paper on Andy's floor were none of the above, and I was no wiser for having crawled around on my hands and knees reading them. The business of private investigation is fraught with indignities. The medicine cabinet in his bathroom had been cleared out. Shampoo, deodorant, and shaving gear were gone. Wherever he was, he'd be clean-shaven and smell good. In his bedroom, all of the dirty clothes were gone, and the blue plastic crates had been emptied of their contents. One tatty pair of boxer shorts remained, wild with fuchsia exclamation marks. I'm always amazed by men's underwear. Who would guess such things by looking at their sober three-piece suits? He'd left behind his bicycle, rowing machine, and the remaining moving cartons. There were still a few poorly folded sheets in the linen closet, one package of pizza rolls in the freezer. He'd taken the bottle of Aquavit and the Milky Way bars, perhaps anticipating his life on the road as an endless round of sugar and alcohol abuse. The card table was still in place, the answering machine on top, aluminum lawn chairs pulled up as if he'd had dinner guests for a banquet of lean cuisine. I sat down, propped my feet up on the adjacent chair, and surveyed Andy's makeshift office. There were still some pencils, a scratch pad, gummy whiteout, unpaid bills. His answering machine turned out to be a duplicate of mine. I reached over and flipped open the side panel where the oft-dialed numbers were penned in. Of the 16 spaces allotted, only 6 were filled. Andy was real imaginative. Fire, police, California Fidelity, his ex-wife, a liquor store, and a pizza joint with free delivery. I stared at the display on the answering machine, thinking about the features on this model. Carefully, I pressed the asterisk button to the left of O. On my machine, the asterisk redials the last number called. With a flurry of notes up and down the scale, the machine redialed, the number displayed in green. It was vaguely familiar, and I made a note of it. The line began to ring. 3 times, 4. Someone picked up. There was a whir and a pause as a machine on the far end of the line came to life. "Hello, this is Olive Kohler at 555-3282. Sorry we're not here to take your call. I'm out at the supermarket at the moment, but I should be home at 4:30 or so. If you'll leave your number and a message, I'll get back to you as soon as I return. If you're calling with confirmation for the New Year's party, just leave your name and we'll see you this evening. Bye for now." I could feel my heart thump. No one had changed the message since Olive's death, and there she was again, perpetually hung up in New Year's Eve day, leaving a verbal note before she went off to shop for the party that would never take place. Perversely, I pressed the asterisk again. 4 rings, and Olive answered, her voice sounding hollow but full of life. She was still going out to shop for the New Year's party, still requesting the caller's name, telephone number, and a message. "Bye for now," she said. I knew if I called 100 times, she'd still be saying, "Bye for now," without ever knowing how final that farewell would be. Andy's last phone call had been to her. But what did it mean? A tiny jolt of memory shot through me. I saw Olive unlock the front door, her arms loaded with groceries, the package bomb, addressed to Terry, resting on top. As the door swung open, the telephone had rung, and that's why she'd tossed the package in such haste. Maybe Andy knew the package was waiting on the doorstep and had called to warn them off. I closed up Andy's apartment, got in my car, and headed back to town, detouring en route to wolf down a fast-food lunch. The Kohler's house was the next logical stop, but as I turned into the lane, I noticed a whisper of anxiety. I had not, of course, been to the house since the bomb went off, and I was not eager to live through the trauma again. I parked in front and gingerly stepped through the gap in the hedge where the gate had been. Only the posts remained now, the hardware twisted where the force of the bomb had wrenched the heavy wooden gate from its hinges. In places, the blast had left the shrubbery completely bald. I approached the house. Plywood sheets and 2x4s had been nailed across the yawning opening where the front door had been. One of the columns supporting the porch roof had been snapped in two, and a clumsy 6x6 had been rigged up in its place. The walkway was scorched, grass sparse and blackened. Sawhorses and warning signs cautioned folks to use the rear. I could still detect the faint briny smell of the cocktail onions that had littered the yard like pearls. I felt my gaze drawn irresistibly to the spot where Olive had lain in a tumbled bloody heap. I remembered then how I'd offered to carry the package for her, since her arms were loaded with grocery bags. Her casual refusal had saved me. Death sometimes passes us by that way, with a wink, a nod, and an impish promise to return for us at another time. I wondered if Terry felt the same guilt I did that she died in our stead. I was holding my breath, and I shook my arms out like a runner in the middle of a race, moving then toward the rear of the house. I knocked at the back door, cupping my hand against the glass to see if Terry or the housekeeper was home. There was no sign of anyone. I waited, then knocked again. In the lower right-hand corner of the kitchen window, there was an alarm company decal that said "Armed Response" across the bottom. I stepped back so I could scan the area. There was a red light showing on the alarm panel to the right, indicating that the system was armed. If the light was green, any burglar would know it was safe to start work. I took a business card from my handbag and sketched a quick note, asking Terry to call me when he got home. I got in my car again and drove to the woods. For all I knew, he was still there. Early afternoon sunlight poured down on the house with its dazzling white facade. The grass was newly cut, as short and densely green as woolpile carpeting. Beyond the bluffs, the ocean was an intense navy blue, the surface feathered with white caps that suggested a strong wind coming off the water. The hot desert wind was blowing at my back, and the palms tossed restlessly where the two met. Ash's little red sports car was parked in the circular driveway, along with a BMW. There was no sign of Terry's Mercedes. I walked around the house to the long, low brick porch on the seaward side and rang the bell. The maid let me in and left me in the foyer while she went to fetch Miss Ebony. I had asked for Ash, but I was willing to take pot luck. I wished fervently that I had a theory, but this was still a fishing expedition. I couldn't be far from understanding the truth, but I had no clear concept what the revelation might be. Under the circumstances, all I knew to do was persist, plowing through. Bass was the only member of the family I was hoping to avoid. Not that it made any difference at that point, but pride is pride. Who wants to make small talk with your ex-spouse's lover? I had to be careful that my sense of injury didn't get in the way of spotting his role in this. "Hello, Kinsey." Ebony was standing at the bottom of the stairs, her pale oval face as smooth as an egg, expressionless, composed. She was wearing a shirtwaist dress of black silk that emphasized her wide shoulders and slim hips, the long, shapely legs. Her red spike heels must have added 5 inches to her height. Her hair was skinned back from the taut bones of her face. A swath of blusher on each cheek suggested high stress instead of the good health it was meant to convey. In the family mythology, she was the thrill-seeker, addicted to the sorts of treacherous hobbies that can spell early death, skydiving, helicopter skiing, climbing the sheer faces of impossible cliffs. In the family dynamic, maybe she'd been designated to live recklessly, just as Bass lived with vanity, idleness, and self-indulgence. I said, "I thought we should talk."
"About what?"
"Olive's death. Lyda Case is dead, too."
"Bass told me that."
My smile had a bitter feeling to it. "Ah, Bass, how did he get involved? Somehow I get the feeling you might have put a call through to him in New York."
"That's right."
"Dirty pool, Ebony." She shrugged, undismayed.
"It's your own damn fault."
"My fault?"
"I asked you what was going on and you wouldn't say. It's my family, Kinsey. I have a right to know."
"I see. And who thought about bringing Daniel into it?"
"I did, but Bass was the one who tracked him down. He and Daniel had an affair years ago until Bass broke it off. There was unfinished business between them. Daniel was more than happy to accommodate him in the hope of rekindling the fires."
"Selling me out in the process," I said. She smiled lightly, but her gaze was intent.
"You didn't have to agree, you know. You must have had some unfinished business of your own, or you wouldn't have been suckered in so easily."
"True," I said. "That was smart. God, he nicked right in there and gave you everything, didn't he?"
"Not quite."
"Oh, something missing? Some little piece of the scheme incomplete?"
"We still don't know who killed Olive."
"Or Lyda Case," I said, though the motive was probably not the same. I suspect she somehow figured out what was going on. Maybe she went back through Hugh's papers and came up with something significant.
"Like what?"
"Hey, if I knew that, I'd probably know who killed her, wouldn't I?" Ebony stirred restlessly.
"I have things to do. Why don't you tell me what you want?"
"Well, let's see. Just in rambling around town, it occurred to me that it might help to find out who inherits Olive's stock."
"Stock?"
"Her 10 voting shares. Surely those wouldn't be left to someone outside the family. So who'd she leave them to?" For the first time, she was genuinely flustered, and the color in her cheeks seemed real.
"What difference does it make? The bomb was meant for Terry. Olive died by mistake, didn't she?"
"I don't know. Did she?" I snapped back. "Who stands to benefit? You? Lance?"
"Ash," came the voice.
"Olive left all her stock to her sister Ashley."
Mrs. Wood had appeared in the upstairs hall. I looked up to see her clinging to the rail, the walker close by, her whole body trembling with exertion.
"Mother, you don't have to concern yourself with this."
"I think I do.
Come to my room, Kinsey."
Mrs. Wood disappeared. I glanced at Ebony and then pushed past her and went up the stairs. Chapter 24. The Last Chapter. We sat in her room near French doors that opened onto a balcony facing the sea. Sheer curtains were pulled across the doorway, billowing lazily in a wind that smelled of salt. The bedroom suite was dark and old, a clumsy assortment of pieces she and Woody must have salvaged from their early married years. A dresser with chipped veneer, matching misshapen lamps with dark red silk shades. I was reminded of thrift store windows filled with other people's junk. Nothing in the room would qualify as collectible, much less antique. She sat in a rocker upholstered in horsehair, frayed and shiny, picking at the fabric on the arms of the chair. She looked awful. The skin on her face had been blanched by Olive's death, and her cheeks were mottled with liver spots and threaded with visible capillaries. She looked as though she'd lost weight in the last few days, the flesh hanging in pleats along her upper arms, her bones rising to the surface like a living lesson in anatomy. Even her gums had shrunk away from her teeth, the aging process suddenly as visible as in time-lapse photography. She seemed weighed down with some as yet unidentified emotion that left her eyes red-rimmed and lusterless. I didn't think she'd survive it, whatever it was. She had clumped her way back to her room with the aid of her walker, which she kept close to her, holding on to it with one trembling hand. I sat in a hard-backed chair near hers, my voice low. "You know what's going on, don't you?" I said.
"I think so. I should have spoken up sooner, but I so hoped my suspicions were groundless. I thought we'd buried the past. I thought we'd moved on, but we haven't. There's so much shame in the world as it is. Why add to it?
Her voice quavered and her lips trembled as she spoke. She paused, struggling with some inner admonition.
I promised Woody I wouldn't speak of it again.
You have to, Helen. People are dying. For a moment her dark eyes sparked to life.
I know that, she snapped.
The energy was short-lived, a match flaring out.
You do the best you can, she went on. You try to do what's right. Things happen and you salvage what's left.
Nobody's blaming you.
I blame myself. It's my fault. I should have said something the minute things began to go wrong. I knew the connection, but I didn't want to believe it, fool that I am.
Is this related to Woody? She shook her head. Who, then?
Lance, she whispered. It started with him.
Lance, I said, disconcerted. It was the last name I expected to hear.
You'd think the past could be diffused, that it wouldn't have the power to affect us so long after the fact.
How far back does this go?
17 years, almost to the day.
She clamped her mouth shut, then shook her head again.
Lance was a hellion in his teens, rebellious and secretive. He and Woody clashed incessantly, but boys do that. Lance was at an age when, of course, he had to assert himself.
Ash says he had a couple of scrapes with the law back then. She stirred impatiently.
He was constantly in trouble. Acting out, they call it now. But I didn't think he was a bad boy. I still don't. He had a troubled adolescence.
She broke off, taking a deep breath.
I don't mean to belabor the point. What's done is done. Woody finally sent him off to military school, and after that he went into the army. We hardly saw him until he came home that Christmas on leave. He seemed fine by then, grown up, mature, calm and pleasant and civil to us both. He became interested in the company. He talked about settling down and learning the business. Woody was thrilled.
She fumbled in her pocket for a handkerchief, which she pressed to her lips, blotting the film of perspiration that had formed like dew. So far she wasn't telling me a thing I didn't already know. What happened?
That year, when Lance came home and things were going so well. That year, it was New Year's Day. I remember how happy I was things were off to such a good start. Then Bass came to us with the most preposterous tale. Somehow in my heart I suppose I've always blamed him. He spoiled everything. I've never really forgiven him, though it was hardly his fault. Bass was 13 then, sly. He knew about wickedness even at that age, and he enjoyed it all so very much.
Still does, I thought. What did he tell you?
He said he'd walked in on Lance. He came straight to us with that sneaky look in his eyes, pretending to be so upset when he knew exactly what he was about. At first, Woody didn't believe a word of it.
He walked in on Lance doing what?
There was a silence, and then she pushed on, her voice dropping so low I was forced to lean closer. With Olive, she whispered. Lance and Olive, in her room on the bed. She was 16 and so beautiful. I thought I'd die of the shame and embarrassment, the loathing at what was going on. Woody was crazed. He was in a towering rage. Lance swore it was innocent, that Bass misunderstood. But that was nonsense. Absurd to think we'd believe any such thing. Woody beat Lance to within an inch of his life. A fearful beating. I thought he'd kill him. Lance swore it only happened once. He swore he'd never lay another hand on her, and he honored that. I know he did.
That's when Olive was sent away to boarding school, I said. Helen nodded.
Who else knew about the incident? No one, just the five of us. Lance and Olive, Bass and Woody and me. Ebony was off in Europe. Ash knew something dreadful had happened, but she never knew what it was.
There was a silence. Helen smoothed the frayed fabric on the arm of the rocker where she'd picked strands loose. She glanced at me. Her expression seemed tinged with guilt, like an old dog that's piddled somewhere you haven't discovered yet. There was more, something she didn't want to own up to.
"What's the rest?" I asked. "What else?"
She shook her head, her cheeks turning pink in patches.
"Just tell me, Helen. It can't matter now." "Yes, it does," she whispered.
She'd begun to weep. I could see her clamped down, forcing her feelings back into the box she'd kept them in all these years. I waited so long that I didn't think she meant to finish. Her hands began to shake in a separate dance of their own, a jitterbug of anxiety. Finally she spoke.
Lance was lying about the two of them. It had gone on for years. Woody never knew, but I suspected as much.
You suspected Lance was abusing her and you never interfered?
What could I say? I had no proof. I kept them away from each other whenever I could. He'd go off to summer camp. She'd stay with friends of ours in Maine. I never left them alone in the house. I hoped it was a phase, something that would disappear of its own accord. I thought if I called attention to it... I don't know what I thought. It was so unspeakable. A mother doesn't sit a boy down and discuss such things. I didn't want to pry, and Olive denied the slightest suggestion that anything was amiss. If she'd come to me, I'd have stepped in. Of course I would, but she never said a word. She might have been the one who initiated the contact, for all I knew.
How long did this go on? I was having a hard time keeping the judgment out of my voice, afraid if she sensed the full range of my outrage, she'd clam up.
Lance was obsessed with her almost from infancy. He was 5 when she was born, and I was so relieved, you see, that he didn't resent her. It was just him and Ebony until Olive came along. He'd been the baby, so I was delighted he seemed taken with her. It must have started as childish curiosity and advanced to something else. It did end once they were discovered. They could hardly tolerate each other's company these past few years, but by then the damage had been done. She had terrible problems.
Sexual problems, I'd assume. Helen nodded, cheeks coloring.
She also suffered deep depressions that would go on for months. All she did was run, 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 anything to escape the feelings. Play and spend, spend and play, that's how she lived.
Rapidly I sorted through all the things I'd been told, processing the trivia I'd picked up in passing. Olive said she and Bass had a falling out when he was home for Thanksgiving. What was that about?
Something silly. I don't even remember now what the subject matter was. One of those ridiculous spats people get into when they've drunk too much. Bass was furious and wanted to get back at her.
But it wasn't about anything. Petty temper, that's all. I watched her carefully, making my mind a blank, trying to let the sense of this filter in. It had started with Lance, with Wood Warren, talk of a takeover, evidence of insurance fraud. Someone had set Lance up, and I'd been caught in the same trap. When Olive died, I'd assumed it was business-related, an accident. It was meant to look like that, but it wasn't. I felt the answer leap at me, so obvious once I knew what had gone on.
"Oh, shit," I said. "Bass told Terry, didn't he?" "I think so," she said almost inaudibly. "I don't think Terry's like the rest of us. He's not a well man. He doesn't seem right to me. Even when they met, he seemed off somehow. But he was crazy about Olive."
"Obsessed is the word I've heard applied," I broke in. "That he worshipped the ground she walked on."
"Oh, he adored her. There's no doubt of that. It was just what she needed, and I thought it would all work out. She had such a low opinion of herself all her life. She couldn't seem to sustain a relationship until Terry came along. I thought she deserved a little happiness."
"You mean because she was damaged goods, don't you? Tainted by what Lance had done?"
"Well, she was tainted. Who knows what bestial appetites Lance had wakened in her?"
"That was hardly her fault."
"Of course not. But what nice boy was ever going to look at her if the truth came out? Terry seemed like a godsend."
"So the two of you decided not to say anything to him?"
"We never spoke of it between us," she said tartly. "So we could hardly speak of it to him. Why stir up trouble when everything was going so well?"
I got up abruptly and went to the phone, dialing Lieutenant Dolan's number at the Santa Teresa PD. The clerk said she'd put me through, and I waited for Dolan's line to ring. Helen was right. What was done was done. There wasn't any point in blaming Bass. If anything, the blame lay with Helen and Woody. Olive died because Helen was too bloody polite to deal with the truth. "Where's Terry now?" I said to Helen over my shoulder. She was weeping openly. It seemed a little late for tears, but I didn't say so.
"He was here a short while ago. He's on his way home."
When Dolan answered, I identified myself and laid it out for him, chapter and verse.
"I'll have him picked up for questioning," Dolan said. We'll get a warrant so we can search the premises. He put that bomb together somewhere. He might have assembled it at work. We'll check that, he said. Hang on.
He put his hand across the mouth of the receiver, and I could hear him issue an order to someone else in the room. He came back on the line.
Let me tell you what we have on this end. We got a match on the prints we lifted from the rental car Lida Case was found in. They belonged to a fellow named Chris Ems, who was charged with the murder of his foster mother 20 years ago. Blew her up with a package bomb he sent through the mail. The jury brought in a verdict of temporary insanity.
Oh, geez, I get it. No prison for him.
Right. He was committed to the state hospital at Camarillo and escaped after 18 months.
And he was never picked up?
He's been free as a bird. I just talked to one of the staff docs, and they're hunting up the old records to see what else they have on him.
Was he really nuts or faking it?
Anybody who does what he did is nuts.
Will you let the family know as soon as he's in custody?
Will do. I'll send somebody over in the meantime, just in case he decides to come back.
You better beef up security at Wood Warren, too. He may make a try for Lance.
Right, Dolan said.
He broke off the connection. I left Helen huddled in the rocker. I went downstairs looking for Ebony and told her what was going on. When I let myself out, she was on her way upstairs to see her mother. I couldn't imagine what they'd talk about. I had a flash of Olive sailing through the air, flying to oblivion. I just couldn't shake the image. I drove home feeling low, my perpetual state these days. I get tired of digging around in other people's dirty laundry. I'm sick of knowing more about them than I should. The past is never nice. The secrets never have to do with acts of benevolence or good deeds suddenly coming to light. Nothing's ever resolved with a handshake or a heart-to-heart talk. So often humankind just seems tacky to me, and I don't know what the rest of us are supposed to do in response. Under the bandages, my burns were chafed and fiery hot, throbbing dully. I glanced at myself in the rearview mirror. With my hair singed across the front and my eyebrows gone, I looked startled somehow. As if unprepared for the sudden conclusion to the case at this point. Quite true. I hadn't had time to process events. I thought about Daniel and Bass. Mentally, I had to close the door on them, but it felt like unfinished business, and I didn't like that. I wanted closure, surcease. I wanted peace of mind again. I pushed through the gate, pulling mail out of the box as I passed. I let myself into my place and slung my handbag on the couch. I felt a desperate need to take a bath, symbolic as it was. It was only 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but I was going to scrub up and then go pound on Rosie's door. It was Tuesday, and she was bound to be back in business by now. My neighborhood tavern usually opens at 5 o'clock, but maybe I could sweet-talk her into letting me in early. I needed a heavy Hungarian dinner, a glass of white wine, and someone to fuss at me like a mother. I paused at my desk and checked my answering machine. There were no messages. The mail was dull. Belatedly, I registered the fact that my bathroom door was closed. I hadn't left it that way. I never do. My apartment is small, and the light from the bathroom window helps illuminate the place. I turned my head, and I could feel the hair rise on the back of my neck. The knob rotated, and the door swung open. That portion of the room was in shadow at that hour of day, but I could see him standing there. My spinal column turned to ice, the chill radiating outward to my limbs, which I couldn't will to move. Terry emerged from the bathroom and circled the couch. In his right hand, he had a gun pointed right at my gut. I felt my hands rise automatically, palms up. The classic posture of submission guns seemed to inspire. Terry said,
"Oops, you caught me. I expected to be gone by the time you got home."
"What are you doing here?"
"I brought you a present."
He made a gesture toward the kitchenette. Trance-like, I turned to see what he was pointing to. On the counter was a shoebox wrapped in Christmas paper. White ho-ho-hos emblazoned on a dark green background with a cartoon Santa swinging from each O. A preformed red satin bow was stuck to the lid. Surprise, surprise! Terry Kohler wanted me to have a box of death.
"Nice," I managed, though my mouth was dry.
"Aren't you going to open it?"
I shook my head. "I think I'll just leave it where it is. I'd hate to give it a bump."
"This one's on a timer."
I managed to loosen my jaw, but I couldn't form any words. Where had I put my gun? My mind was washed absolutely blank. I reached for the edge of my desk, supporting myself with my fingertips. Bombs are loud. The end is quick. I cleared my throat. "Sorry to interrupt you," I said. "Don't stick around on my account."
"I can stay for a minute. We could have a little chat."
"Why kill me?"
"It seemed like a good idea," he said mildly. "I thought you might like to go out with a bang, as opposed to a you-know-what."
"I'm surprised you didn't try for Lance."
"I have a package just like it in the car for him."
Probably in the bottom of my handbag, I thought. I'd meant to take it to the gun shop. Had I stuck it in the briefcase in the back seat of my car? If so, it was still out there, and my ass was grass.
"Do you mind if I sit?"
He did a quick survey of the area, making sure there weren't any rifles, bullwhips, or butcher knives within range.
"Go ahead."
I moved to the couch and sank down without taking my eyes off him. He pulled my desk chair closer and sat down, crossing his legs. He was a nice-looking man, dark and lean, on the slight side. There was nothing in his manner to indicate how nuts he was. How nuts is he, I thought. How far gone? How amenable to reason? Would I trade my life for bizarre sexual favors if he asked? Oh, sure, why not? I was having trouble appraising the situation. I was home where I should have been safe. It wasn't even dark out. I really needed to pee, but it sounded like a ploy. And honest to God, I was embarrassed to make the request. It seemed advisable to try opening a dialogue, one of those conversations designed to ingratiate.
"What's the timetable here?"
He glanced at his watch.
10 minutes, more or less. The bomb should go off at 4:30. "I was worried you wouldn't get home in time," he said. "I can reset it, but I don't want to mess the wrapping paper up."
"I can understand that," I said. I checked the clock on my desk. 4:22. I could feel my adrenal gland squirt some juice into my veins. Terry didn't seem concerned.
"You seem calm enough," I remarked.
He smiled.
"I'm not going to be around when the damn thing goes off. They're dangerous."
"How can you keep me here? You'll have to shoot me first."
"I'll tie you up. I have some rope."
I could see then that he had a coil of clothesline he'd tossed on the kitchen floor. "You think of everything," I said. I wanted him to talk. I didn't want him to tie me up, because then I'd be dead for sure. There wasn't going to be any way to hump and thump my way out. No broken glass by which I could saw through my ropes. No knives, no tricks, no miracles.
"What if it goes off prematurely?"
"Too bad," he said with mockery. "But you know what Dylan Thomas said. After the first death, there is no other."
"How does Hugh Case fit in? Do you mind if I ask? I just want to know for the sake of it."
"I don't mind. We don't have anything else to talk about. Hugh was made the security officer after Woody bid on a government contract. We were all going to have clearances, but the guy went overboard. Forms, interviews, all these questions. He really took himself seriously. At first I thought it was all a game, but gradually I realized he was coming up with too many penetrating questions. He knew. Of course he wanted my fingerprints. I stalled as long as possible, but I couldn't refuse. I had to kill him before he told Woody all the sordid details."
"About your mother?"
"Foster mother," he corrected.
"Wouldn't somebody else have come up with the same information?"
"I'd figured a way around it, but I needed him out of the way for it to work."
"But you don't know that he was actually onto you?"
"Oh, but I do, and he was. I destroyed the file he kept at work, but he had a duplicate at home." "Talk about a breach of security," he said. "That came to light just recently."
"Lyda found it."
"Now that was your fault. After you flew to Texas, she went through the papers she'd packed up and came across all the data on Chris Ems. She had no idea who he was, but she figured it was someone at the plant. She called me from Dallas and said she had some information Hugh had unearthed. I told her I'd be happy to take a look at it and help her figure out what to do with it. She made me promise not to mention it to Lance, since she was so suspicious of him anyway."
"Nice," I said. "And the threat from her, you just made that up?"
"Yep."
"And the day we waited at the bird refuge, she was already dead out in front?"
"Rightio," he said.
"How'd you kill Hugh?"
Terry shrugged indifferently.
"Chloral hydrate.
Then I strolled in and stole his blood and urine sample so it couldn't be traced.
"Takes nerve," I said.
It had to be done, and I knew I was right. I couldn't have him upsetting my life.
What made me so mad afterwards, of course, is it was all for nothing. Olive had a past just as bad as mine. I didn't need to protect myself at all. I could have traded her, tit for tat, if she'd leveled with me.
"You must feel better now that she's gone. She's been paid in full, hasn't she?"
His face clouded.
I should have killed Lance and left her alive. I could have made her life miserable.
I thought you'd already done that.
Well, yes, but she didn't suffer nearly enough, and now she's off the hook.
She did love you, I said.
So what?
So, nothing. I guess love doesn't count for much with you.
I felt my eyes stray to the clock. 4:25. Not when it's based on lies and deceit, he said piously. She should have told me the truth. She never shared the facts. She let me go right on believing our sex life was all my fault. She made me think I was inadequate when all the time it was her. Sometimes I think about him with his mouth all over her, feeding like a leech, sucking at her everywhere. Disgusting, he said.
That was a long time ago.
Not long enough.
What about Andy Motyka? How'd you persuade him to help?
Money and threats. The carrot and the stick. Janice was hosing him for every cent he had. I paid him 10 grand. Every time he got nervous, I reminded him that I'd be happy to tell Janice about Lorraine if he tried to back out.
How'd you find out about her?
We've all known each other for years. The four of us went to UCST together before he and Janice got married. This was after I conjured up my new identity, of course. Once I settled on the frame-up, it didn't take much to figure out he was in the perfect position to assist me.
Did you kill him, too?
I wish I had. He ducked out on me. But I'll find a way to lure him back. He's not very smart.
Even with the tinnitus I suffer, I could have sworn I could hear the package bomb ticking merrily. I wet my lips. Is there really a clock in there? Is that how it works?
He glanced over at the kitchen counter. It's not a complicated device. The one for Olive was more elaborate, but I had to make sure it would detonate on impact.
It's amazing I wasn't killed then.
Might have simplified things, he said.
Then how he'd bent to recoil the hose lying on the walk. Any excuse to hang back out of range. I was beginning to feel strangely free. The time left was brief, but it was beginning to stretch and sag like a long strand of chewing gum. It seemed absurd to think I'd spend the last minutes of my life discussing trivial points with the man who was going to do me in.
Oh, hell, why not, you know?
I flashed again to my brief flight off the front of Olive's porch while she soared beyond me like a bird. A death like that barely registers. What scared me was surviving, maimed and burned, living long enough to feel the loss of self. Time to make a move, I thought, regardless of the consequences.
Once your life is threatened, what else do you have to lose?
I reached for my handbag. I've got some tranks in my bag, do you mind? He seemed startled, waving his gun at me.
Leave it where it is.
I'm a wreck, Terry. I really need a Valium. Then you can tie me up.
No, he said peevishly. Don't touch it. I mean it.
Come on, indulge me. It's a small request. I pulled the bag over and unzipped the top, rooting through the contents until I located the cross-hatched ivory handle of my beloved 32 and eased the safety off. He couldn't believe I'd disobey him, but he couldn't seem to think what to do. As he rose to his feet, I fired through the bottom of the handbag at a range of 10 feet without any visible effect. He did jump, as if I'd tossed hot gravy on his pants, but I didn't see blood, and he didn't topple to the floor as I'd sincerely prayed he would. Instead, he roared to life, coming at me like a mad dog. I pulled the gun out of my purse to fire again, but he was on me, taking me with him to the floor. I saw his fist come at me, and I jerked to the right. The blow landed on my left ear, which rang with pain. I scrambled up, grabbing at the couch for support. I had no idea where my gun had gone, but he was aiming his at me. I snatched up my handbag and swung it. I caught him in the head. The momentum knocked him sideways. He was blocking my passage to the front door, so I veered the other way and raced into the bathroom. I slammed the door after me, turning the lock, and hit the floor. He fired twice, bullets zinging through the door like bees. There was no way out. The bathroom window was right in the line of fire, and I couldn't see anything to defend myself with. He started kicking at the door, savage blows that splintered the wood on impact.
I saw his foot come through the panel, and he kicked again. His hand shot through the hole, and he fumbled for the lock. I jerked the lid off the toilet tank and cracked him a blow. I heard him yelp, and he snatched his hand back through the hole. He fired again, screaming obscenities. Suddenly his face appeared in the gap, eyes roving wildly as he searched for my location. The nose of the gun peered at me. All I could think to do was to protect myself with a tank lid, holding it in front of me like a shield. The bullet slammed into it with a clang, the impact fierce enough to jolt the lid right out of my hands, breaking it in two. Terry started kicking at the door again, but the blows were losing force. On the other side, I heard him fall heavily. I froze, astonished, gasping for breath. There wasn't time to wait to see if he was faking it. I flipped the lock, shoving at the door, which I couldn't budge. I dropped to my knees and peered at him through the panel. He was flat on his back, his shirt front drenched in red. Apparently I'd wounded him the first time I fired, but it had taken him this long to go down. Blood seeped from him like a slow leak from a worn tire. His chest was still heaving. Above his stertorous breathing, I could hear the package ticking like a grandfather clock. "Get out of the doorway! Terry, move!" He was unresponsive. The clock on my desk said 4:29. I shoved as hard as I could, but there was no budging him. I had to get out of there. Frantically, I glanced around the room and then grabbed up one half of the broken toilet tank. I smashed at the window. Glass showered out into the front yard, leaving fangs of glass in the frame. I grabbed a towel and wedged it over the glass ragged sill as I boosted myself up. The boom from the explosion propelled me through the window like Superman in full flight. I landed on the grass with a whunk that knocked the wind right out of me. For a moment I felt the panic of paralysis, wondering if I'd ever breathe again. Debris was raining down around me. I saw a hunk of the roof hover briefly above me like a UFO. Then it began to tumble and bounce down through the intervening branches of a tree. A cloud of white smoke drifted into view and began to disperse. I angled my gaze up to the wall behind me, which seemed to be intact. My sofa bed was sitting in the driveway with the cushions askew. Perched on the arm was my perky green air fern, looking like it had hopped up there by itself. I knew the whole front wall of my apartment would be gone, the interior a shambles, all my possessions destroyed. Lucky I don't have much in this world, I thought. I was temporarily deaf again, but I was getting used to it. Eventually, with effort, I roused myself and went back inside to see if there was anything of Terry left. Epilogue. Henry Pitts came home to find a crater where his rental unit had been. He was more distressed about my troubles in his absence than any damage to his property, which was covered by insurance. He has big plans now about building a new studio for me, and he's already conferring with an architect. I managed to salvage a few articles of clothing, among them my all-purpose dress and my favorite vest. What could I complain about? As soon as I was on my feet again, I went back to work. Mac arranged for California Fidelity to refurbish my office as a way of making amends for my temporary suspension. Andy Motika was fired, and criminal charges were filed against him. The DA's office probably whited my name out and typed his in its place. Within 2 days of the explosion, Daniel left with Bass. I can't say I felt much. After all I'd been through, his betrayal seemed beside the point. In surveying the situation, I decided there was only one other matter that needed cleaning up. I conferred with Lieutenant Dolan in private about the $5,000 Terry deposited to my account. He advised me to keep my mouth shut, which I did. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This concludes the reading of E is for Evidence by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer.